Okay. Did everybody hear that, or only I hear that?
Yep,
I heard it.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, so we are recording. Let me say a couple of introductory words. One is that we don't have any way of protecting confidentiality, so if you discuss any kind of case material, make double sure that it's, you know, disguised or anything like that. Please press your mute button. Because the background noise can get really pretty oppressive. Let me just welcome you all. This is sponsored by Division 50 of APA, the Society of Addiction Psychology. We're always interested in people taking an interest in us, and anyone has an interest in joining up, finding more about it, feel free to contact me. This is Mark Schenker. And with no further ado, let me introduce you, Joe Nowinski. Dr. Nowinski's had positions as assistant professor of psychiatry at University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. He's been an adjunct associate professor at the University of Connecticut, supervising psychologist at the University of Connecticut Health Center. He's the principal author and architect of the 12-step facilitation model, and he wrote the book and is currently working on the second edition, to be published next year. He's now working on an independent clinical consulting practice in Connecticut. And I would also add that you wrote a book surveying some of the research on 12-step work last year, and which I thought was very helpful. So with no further ado again, here's Dr. Nowinski.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I guess just to give you a little background of what I thought I'd do today was to present a little bit about 12-step facilitation. I, to give you some background, I was fortunate enough to be asked to develop the 12-step intervention for Project Match way back. And the impetus for that was the Institute of Medicine white paper that was issued in 1989, which said that, basically Alcoholics Anonymous, which was such a widely used program, had never been subject to any kind of rigorous research. And that white paper really was largely responsible for the development of this intervention, which I called 12-step facilitation. And a lot of subsequent research. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today, because 12-step facilitation was developed for Project Match. At the time, there really was not any very good rigorous research, randomized clinical trial, et cetera, on the 12-step approach. And frankly, it was viewed with a lot of skepticism in the academic and research communities. I did develop it. I did publish a book back in, I believe it was 1992, was the first publication of the handbook. Since then, I've been involved in a number of consulting through a number of clinical trials. I've also kept track of the research. And based on that, that's why I am developing a second edition of 12-step facilitation. So I thought we'd talk about that today. Talk about what it is, what are some of the criticisms of the 12-step approach. I have to say that I'm not a representative of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no affiliation with them. And 12-step facilitation is not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? There's no formal affiliation at all there. It's an intervention that was developed and using the 12-step Minnesota model, though. So I guess you could just follow the bouncing ball, okay, with my PowerPoint, if everybody's got it. And I titled it 12-step facilitation and the science of 12-step recovery because, as I said, 12-step facilitation was developed and used in Project Match and then subsequently used in research. But there had been no real scientific, evidence of it before that. So let me see if I can get my PowerPoint working here. So I kind of talk about the Force Awakens. It's kind of I think that no one, people were pretty skeptical of the 12-step model back then when Project Match was first conceived. So the subsequent research, including Project Match, is sort of, I think, relevant to what we're talking about here. Let's take a look at some of the criticisms that are very commonly waged, you know, leveled against the Alcoholics Anonymous. Dan Peel's a leader in this. He says AA is ruining the world, and why it will hurt societies because it denies reality. It overemphasizes its own success. It rules out other more effective approaches, and its temperance message actually creates alcoholism and addiction. It will be talking about some of those criticisms. Interestingly, AA doesn't even report on its success other than for every 3 years it does triennial member surveys, but it doesn't really report on outcome at all. It has nothing to say about other treatment programs. It's a program of attraction. It doesn't rule out anything. And this issue comes up about whether it's a temperance movement. We'll talk about that. Lance Doates, who recently wrote a book called The Sober Truth, he's a psychoanalyst, says AA has the worst success rate in all of medicine. And he, I've had a couple debates with him. If you go to a website called thefix.com, you'll see one of those at least. And that's his claim. He just sticks to that claim that it helps maybe 2 or 3% of the people, and the rest it doesn't help or even harmful to. Ken Anderson, people may know him. He's affiliated with the harm reduction movement, who basically talks about how going to 12-step meetings harmed him. He almost went into DTs, and so it was only when he quit AA that he started getting better. This picture is this is Ken's Facebook page, by the way. So he's an advocate of harm reduction, which I have nothing against, but if you follow his Facebook page, it's interesting because you'll see that Ken will post things like how many, what's your drink count today? And mine's zero, we'll say. And Monday through Friday, it will be, his drink count will be zero. And then he'll post on Saturday and say, what's your drink count? Mine is 17. And he pretty well regularly, that's his idea of harm reduction. So some of the common complaints. I do a blog for Psychology Today. And by the way, please feel free to interrupt me with questions or comments. You know, I don't want to just drone on. Here are the criticisms that I've heard a lot when I post a blog, that AA promotes powerlessness, right? The AA advocates that people are powerless. We'll look at that because there's some research on that. Bad experiences with a sponsor, that a sponsor might be critical, closed-minded, patronizing. That's true. I think that I believe that some people have had negative experiences with sponsors. But the truth is that people have negative experiences in psychotherapy, too. I'm sure most of us are familiar with complaints like that, people who went to a psychotherapist and they have a terrible experience. In terms of 12-step fellowships, you know, there's no licensing or, you know, qualification for becoming a sponsor. It's supposed to be someone who has, you know, walked the steps before you and is there sort of as a coach or someone to have a relationship with. Then if the criticism of AA is a cult, it brainwashes people, confusing it with a religion. AA misses the underlying causes of substance abuse. This is the psychoanalytic Lance Doates argument that the cure for addiction is psychodynamic psychotherapy. That it's an old psychoanalytic concept, if you're familiar with that, that if you treat the underlying conflict, the underlying cause of the addiction or substance abuse disorder, it'll remit by itself. The AA view, of course, is the opposite. I mean, Lance Doates writes that every addictive act is an expression of powerlessness, and that from his psychodynamic point of view, people turn to substance abuse in order to actually gain control of their lives. Well, of course, the 12-step view is the opposite, that addiction is not that powerlessness causes addiction, but that addiction causes powerlessness. And so from the 12th point of view, people don't turn to opioids in order to gain control of their life, okay? They basically, opioids cause unmanageability and cause them to lose control. And then the last criticism I've heard from people is complaining that it's a social status network, and that those who have acquired some degree of, you know, sobriety, 5 years, 10 years, tend to patronize or look down on people who are newcomers, or that if you have a slip, you're stigmatized. And I think this sometimes may be true as well, depending on the individual or the group they might go to. So we'll look at some of these criticisms, some of which I think are founded. Of course, if it's a sponsorship issue, the solution would be to get another one. The social status thing is interesting. So let's move on. An overview of 12-step facilitation. Who is it for? Basically, it's an abstinence-oriented program. So we have to look at abstinence versus harm reduction. Does it work? What's the empirical evidence? Now, since in the last 20, you'll see most of these publications I talk about have fairly recent pub dates. All of that followed the Institute of Medicine white paper, including Project Match. So we'll take a look at what the empirical evidence is. We'll talk about some of the obstacles to treatment. What is the role of a TSF facilitator? And maybe we'll just take a quick look at content and structure, because it's a very structured intervention. References you can look up later, email, abstinence versus harm reduction. Let's take a look at that. Bill Miller, way before he developed motivational enhancement therapy, was into the issue of controlled drinking. So co-developed a program called Behavioral Self-Control. And it was very much of a cognitive behaviorally oriented treatment. And it involves pretty much what you see in CBT now, goal setting, self-monitoring, self-reinforcement, identifying high-risk situations, alternatives to drinking, very similar to, what we think of as cognitive behavioral therapy. In that study, they had 140 subjects, and they followed them for 3, 5, 7, and 8 years. What they found was that what's important to remember now is that these people were all diagnosed with what we call severe alcohol use disorders now, or what we used to be called alcoholism, okay? So this was the subject pool. So they decided to try behavioral self-control. What they found was that in the long run, 23 of those people voluntarily abstained completely. 14 of the 140 reported non-problem drinking. 22 were impaired, 35 were unremitted, and 46 were just totally unaccounted for. So of that 140, 14 reported non-problem drinking over the long term. Let's take a look at moderation management. Keith Humphreys, a couple of studies published by him, he looked at moderation management members versus AA members. This is a very important study, because what he found was that the problem severity, unlike the study on behavioral self-control, that Humphreys found that the MM members indeed have less severe problems. They tended to be women, and most of them were less than 35 years old. They were more highly educated. They were employed full-time, and they had a family supportive of moderation. So that's an interesting, comparison of the two groups, because, 12-step facilitation is an abstinence-oriented treatment for people with severe alcohol problems. So Humphreys found that, indeed, moderation management seemed to work for this subgroup of people. However, 15% of the MM members did self-report blackouts, tremors, morning craving, work family problems in the prior 6 months, but only 3% of those people later opted for abstinence. So what Humphreys concluded is that moderation management indeed might be something that's appropriate for a particular subgroup of people, but he cautioned because of that 15% that people need to be aware of that, that people reporting these more serious symptoms may need to consider an alternative to moderation.
Joe, quick question. What was the follow-up time of that? I may have missed that.
Well, he didn't, in Humphreys, he just did a survey. This was a survey. It wasn't like a randomized clinical trial. It was just, he reported two different times of 2002 and 2003. I can get you the references if you want.
Yeah, I was just wondering how long the follow-up period was, say, in the prior 6 months. Oh, that's before they began it?
Yeah, I think it was just a retrospective.
Oh.
Yeah.
He was okay, I misunderstood.
What had happened to you, and did you report, experience any of these in the past 6 months? So it led him to conclude that, you know, if you have don't have a very severe problem, if you're fairly young, if you're highly educated, employed, and have family support, then perhaps that approach might be appropriate. But there's that 15% that seems to be much more severe.
Okay, got it.
Okay. Then Bajowski did a big study. This was a study that was part of a study that also includes a medication trial. But there were, 1,200 subjects. And what they did at the beginning for prior treatment is that they asked them to identify their goals, either controlled drinking, total abstinence, or conditional abstinence. Conditional abstinence meant that I'm going to stop drinking for a while, and then I'm going to decide whether I want to drink again. And then they went into treatment, which was sort of a combination treatment. If you look at it, it's predominantly cognitive behavioral intervention plus motivational. And they had up to 20 sessions. But what was interesting here is that you talk about the goals and abstinence versus controlled drinking. And these people all have fairly severe alcohol use disorders. So those men who chose abstinence as their goal at the beginning had the best outcome. Those with a goal of controlled drinking had the worst drinking outcome, and those who chose conditional abstinence had outcomes kind of in between. So there's some more evidence regarding about abstinence versus controlled drinking and who it might be appropriate for.
Can I ask a question about what you just mentioned here? Thanks. The use of the word worst sounds pretty ominous, but it could simply mean out of three groups, they were the worst. And
right.
I don't know, can you tell us a little bit more, did they have what we generally think of as bad drinking outcomes, or were they just not, they were just the third best of these three groups?
Yes, you'd have to look at, well, you know, all of these studies, they take a look at, most of them look at total abstinence, but a lot of them look at drinking days, for example, percentage of drinking days, how often did you drink, and what's called DD drinks per drinking day. So when you did drink, how much did you drink? And that's the kind of analysis that they would do in addition to abstinence. So what this is simply saying is that for this group who had, you know, fairly severe alcohol use disorders, not like the group that Humphrey sort of was surveyed there, that those who actually at the beginning of treatment, before treatment, decided to pursue abstinence, of the three, they had the best outcome. Does that mean that, you know, they had a perfect outcome? Obviously not. So they just had the best. But there does seem to be a relationship between the goal that someone sets and their outcome. And at least for that group of fairly severe drinkers, it kind of reminds me of the Bill Miller study there, you know, fairly severe alcoholics trying to do the behavioral self-control. The question becomes not whether harm reduction or controlled drinking or moderation management works, but the question for who and how does it interact with one's goals, okay? Does that make sense?
Well, it's sort of okay. It's just a little puzzling to me because I remember a study from some years ago that compared imposing a condition on subjects in a controlled study versus letting them choose. And all the people who chose generally did much better. And in this particular slide that you have up, I understand that that one group did worse. If there's three groups,
right,
one does have to do worse than the others. But I don't know if it means that they were still doing as badly as they started, or were they overall nonetheless still improved?
Well, no, I have to look, delve deeper into that than this slide, as I recall. No,
that's okay.
It wasn't that they were doing. They weren't. I know clearly they weren't doing as bad as when they started. Okay, so definite positive effect, and there was a definite. The analysis showed that the treatment goal that they chose, was a moderating factor there.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'll go look at this study myself.
Sure. I can, it's all in the book. I'm not, trying to advertise it, but I got all those references in there.
Okay.
So let's take a look at this issue. And we took a look at some of the criticisms that I put up earlier, AA, 12-step approach is, for example, a temperance movement. It's also criticized as overused, and I think that's true to some extent. But, the new DSM-5, I think, sheds a lot of light on this, because if you take a look, if you stop thinking of substance use problems, in a dichotomy, either you're an addict or you're okay, and you start looking at it in terms of a spectrum, then I think it's moderation management, harm reduction, and 12-step facilitation start to make more sense. Because if you look at the Humphreys survey, probably most of those people would fall into the mild area, I think you might argue, except maybe 15% who reported things like blackouts and tremors, and they're probably on the extreme other end. And then you have low risk, drinking, on the other end, so if you're talking about someone who, with a good diagnosis, is someplace in that mild or maybe in that between the mild and moderate zone, a goal of harm reduction or moderation and using cognitive behavioral therapy interventions and so forth, might be perfectly appropriate. And maybe they would be able to sort of, step back, if you will, back toward the low-risk social, drinking zone. Whereas if someone has, DSM-5 qualifies for a severe problem, then that's where abstinence, not temperance, but abstinence really may be the more appropriate goal. And I think that the research at this point sort of kind of suggests that maybe the idea of pursuing abstinence as opposed to control drinking and setting that as your goal might actually be more desirable. Now, I do take issue with some people who criticize, say, the courts for referring everybody to AA, because certainly not everybody who ends up in court for a DUI or something like that, or even a domestic violence offense, is necessarily, in that severe zone. And I do think that there are some areas where it's overused. I did some consulting out in the Midwest and Indiana, and the AA meetings were inundated there, just inundated with everyone who had gone to court and were told that they had to go to AA, not only had to go to AA, but had to get a sponsor. So there were some people who were being asked to sponsor 30 people, all because the court was mandated. So I think that, DSM-5 actually might help us in deciding, who is 12-step facilitation for, who is abstinence most suitable for as a goal versus harm reduction. Is that making sense to people? So what we're talking about here is who is it for, and what do we know about it? Does it work or not? Does the 12-step model work? And my point here is not that other approaches don't work, but it's been criticized that somehow the 12-step approach ignores other approaches that work. And that's not the case that I'm trying to make. If anything, I'm trying to suggest that the research that we're going to look at suggests that it works as well as other treatments, and perhaps in some cases a little better than some of the other treatments, but not that other treatments don't work. That's the Institute of Medicine thing. So let's take a quick look at member surveys, because this is the closest thing that AA does on research. And they do it every 3 years, and they do it back. You can get them back to 1977. And what's really interesting, these are random samples. These are they just send out samples to various groups, hoping to get a certain sample size. It's not controlled research at all. But what's interesting to me about this survey is going way back to 77. Here you only compare 2007 to 2011. Was the consistency of these reports that 69% in 2007 were sober more than a year? How many males and females? The number of females participating in 12-step programs has grown. How many have a sponsor? Roughly 80%. These numbers tend to be pretty stable over the years. Have a home group? You see that. And how many meetings per week that they attend. Now, this is not sort of, as some people suggest, that reporting that the AA overemphasizes its success. It's simply, it's simply reporting what people say. For me, when I'm doing training, I look at this and I say that therapist, these are treatment targets for you. If you're working with someone, this suggests that getting a sponsor, having a home group, and attending this many meetings per week is where you want to get somebody to by the time they finish with treatment. In 89, 80% had a sponsor. 85% again had a home group. Average meetings per week were 3. But there's an interesting trend that people have often thought that AA is only for alcohol, but this is old data, but look at that. In 1977, 20% said they were also addicted to other drugs. By 1989, it was up to 45%. We don't know right now what it's up to now, because I'm not sure they're asking that question. But you see a tremendous trend of that. And most people today understand that people go to AA not just for alcohol problems, but for other drug problems. They just go there for support. Some of the limitations, obviously, is it's only active AA members. But that's okay from AA's point of view, because it's a program of attraction. If you don't want to go, you don't have to. There's no data on dropouts, because they don't follow dropouts. They don't ask people, they don't seek out dropouts or ask them why. Nor do they ask people if they've returned, interestingly. They just ask them, those simple questions. So that's their survey data. Then we'll take a look at a couple of longitudinal studies. The Moose study, people may be familiar, out of San Francisco, but out of California. They followed Rudolph and his wife followed 362 patients. Interesting, again, this all comes after the this was started before. The Institute of Medicine paper, but it's kind of continued. So just like that other study that said, I said goals, they followed people for 16 years, and they asked them voluntarily at the beginning, okay? This was not a randomized clinical trial. They asked them, did they want to go to AA and not seek treatment? That was group one. Did they opt for AA plus concurrent treatment? Or did they opt for treatment but not go to AA? And then they followed these people, it was amazingly, for this long. They found that group two, the ones who opted for treatment plus going to AA meetings, had the best, most likely to remain clean and sober through 16 years. Again, the question is were hundreds of percent of those people absent from? But not, I'm sure they were not, but they were more likely to. And that people who dropped out of AA at any point were more likely to resume drinking. And you have to look at the details of the study to see that resuming drinking means just that, resuming drinking. Not everybody resumed really severe problem drinking, but the fact is that the data suggests that if we can get people concurrently to start treatment and go to AA at the same time for support, that group seems to be the most likely to succeed in the long run. And also, how long should you go to AA? That's an interesting question because the Moose study shows that any dropping out at any time, that some of those people may have just opted out and decided to drink. But it was associated with more likely return to drinking. McKellar followed that this is a VA study, and they assessed AA involvement. Again, all of this stuff was done post the Institute of Medicine. They studied the 2,300 men who went through the VA system, and they evaluated them 1 and 2 years later. And they looked at AA involvement. This is significant as we move forward because the Moose studies looked at meetings. Okay, did they go to meetings? Now that this Humphrey by McKellar and this study by McKellar and Humphreys looked a little more deeply into AA involvement, not just going to meetings, but getting a sponsor, making AA friends, reading recovery-oriented materials. And they found that greater involvement was positively associated with decreased drinking and fewer drinking-related consequences. Participation and better outcomes were evident regardless of whether these men and women had prior experience with AA. AA participation and better outcome did not depend on having a more severe or less severe drinking problem at the outset. That's kind of interesting because the Project Match found the same thing, that problem severity did not seem to mediate outcome as much as it was expected in Project Match either. The most interesting thing that they discussed is that motivation prior to treatment did not predict AA involvement or drinking-related consequences. And if you read the study, it's interesting as to they discuss why not. Why was motivation not a predictor? And I'll just tell you what they suggest is that motivation is not a static factor. It's more of a dynamic factor, if you know what I mean? So that measuring someone's motivation prior to treatment, that motivation may change as they get into treatment. It may be influenced by their experience. So that's what they suggest, why motivation at the outset was not predictive. And then the next study, fairly recently published, 1,900 men and women. Now, this is interesting because this is a different sample. These were men and women who went through the Kaiser Permanente system in California. So they all had insurance, okay? They all had health insurance. And the only requirement that was made on them is that they attend one AA or any 12-step meeting while they were in treatment, and that anything after that was optional. So they simply required that they go to one 12-step meeting while they were in treatment, and then they followed this large sample over 9 years. And they showed that greater 12-step meeting attendance led to increases in 5-year abstinence and to a lesser extent in 7-year abstinence. What they considered important about this was, again, that this sample was people with alcohol and drug use disorders, which is obviously, we all know, very, very common today. It's hard to find someone who's only using alcohol. And they were insured members of an integrated healthcare organization. So this was kind of a middle-class California population. And again, it's kind of interesting that and 12-step meeting attendance itself seemed to be predictive. This slide speaks to the fact that sometimes if you read criticism of AA, I don't know if any of you have heard this, that 50% of people who go to AA drop out within 3 months, which is true. And so then people conclude that it's a 50% failure rate because they drop out. But if you take a look at adherence rates for any medical condition, what do we find? It's kind of interesting that it's about the same, that people who have hypertension, people who have diabetes, people who have any medical condition, adherence rates run only about 40 to 50%. So, if people say that AA fails 50% of the time because 50% of those people don't, stay after 3 months, the question becomes, does it mean that the 12-step model doesn't work? If 50% of people who have hypertension don't take their medication, does that mean the treatment doesn't work? Or is this really just an artifact of people's relative willingness to adhere to any treatment? So I think the idea that, measuring the success of any treatment simply by the number of people who adhere to it doesn't really kind of reflect its effectiveness.
I think there's also a finding from Bill White that we assume people who drop out do poorly, but there is a lot of people who drop out who just, that was all they needed, and they're doing well. I don't know if there's data on that, but I think that there's...
I'm not right. I'd like to see that. I'm not so familiar with the data on it. I know anecdotally, that's for sure, that people told me that, some people told me that they went to AA for a few months, and then they just either quit drinking or moderate. So maybe they were people who were, in that mild zone to begin with, and that's all they needed. There are also people who told me that they dropped out and came back, of course. They dropped out like Bill Miller's behavioral control study. There may have been people who dropped out and went back. So we don't know, because AA just doesn't do that. It just does simple surveys.
Right.
Okay, I said that TSF is a manual guided intervention based on the 12-step model of recovery. It is not affiliated with AA. It's not an AA publication. I'm not affiliated with AA. But what it did do was allow for the implementation of randomized clinical trials comparing a 12-step model to other treatments, which had never been done before. I won't spend a lot of time on this. Most of you probably know about Project Match. Compared cognitive behavioral therapy to motivational enhancement therapy and 12-step facilitation. In my graduate career, by the way, just as a quick aside, I was trained at the University of Connecticut, and back then it was a very heavy emphasis on CBT. The director of clinical training at that point was a psychologist named Julian Roeder, and his work in social learning theory and locus of control, interpersonal trust, were all very consistent. And so that's a lot of what my background was. I was very interested in Bruce Leese's topic. I think that was last month, where he talked about the fact that CBT has kind of moved toward recognizing the power of the therapeutic relationship, not just the technique. I think that relates to what we're talking about here, because I really think that as we move forward, we'll see that I think what the research even points to is the main curative factor of this 12-step model has to do with relationships, what it really has to do with. And certainly there's a certain amount of advice and so on that goes along with the 12-step fellowships. But the core of it, I think, has a lot to do with relationships. So, and the healing power of those relationships. So then there's motivational enhancement therapy, we're all familiar with, and TSF. CSF's goal is simple, involvement in a recovery fellowship which advocates abstinence from alcohol and drug use and utilizes group support to help members stay clean and sober. From my point of view, it can be AA, NA. It can be Double Trouble in Recovery. There are others like Women for Sobriety. There's Smart Recovery. There's Secular Organizations for Society. There are many of them out there. Of course, AA is the most ubiquitous and easy to access, which is probably why more people go to AA meetings even with other problems. However, from my point of view, any fellowship that a person can connect to, which supports abstinence and uses group support to achieve that goal, is perfectly appropriate. So Project Match, 1 year follow-up, they showed significant sustained improvement in percentage of abstinent days and decreased number of drinks per drinking day. There were no sex differences. Well, of course, if those people are familiar with Project Match, it was not really supposed to be a horse race between CBT, MET, and TSF. Like, one of them was going to work and the other two didn't work at all, or, you know, which was going to win the horse race. Although I do believe that there was a great deal of skepticism about the 12-step approach prior to implementing Project Match. But the idea was that the theory at the time was that these different treatments would be appropriate for different people. So the 12-step facilitation would be appropriate for people who had the most severe problems and so forth. And there was some belief that the 12-step approach would not appeal to women because of the emphasis on powerlessness, so to speak. But it turned out to be no sex differences, no problem severity differences. And interestingly, there was no difference in outcome depending on whether this treatment was implemented as an intensive outpatient program or whether it was part of an aftercare program. So it didn't seem to matter whether these people had gone through treatment before or not. The outcome was comparable. Dick Longabaugh then did a 3-year study follow-up, found that 3 years later, 12-step facilitation and motivational enhancement therapy were more effective than cognitive behavior therapy. I'm not sure exactly why, but that was their finding. But this was the more significant finding to me, that 12-step facilitation was more effective than MET for individuals whose social environment supported drinking. And I just talked about the power of relationships, which is, I think, the key here. So that those people whose social environment, basically their friends, family, and so forth, supported drinking, TSF was more effective. Why? Obviously, because the goal of TSF is try to shift someone's social network toward one supportive of not drinking. And the best single predictor of outcome was AA attendance. How many of you know, that's a thing we see from the Moose study on up, through the Humphrey study in the VA and so forth, and the Kaiser study, that in fact, going to meetings seems to make a difference. Again, this is sort of another follow-up study for clients with social networks supportive of drinking. Post-drinking outcomes were significantly better if they were matched to TSF instead of CBT or MET. I'm not sure I like this quote. Those are mismatched to CBT or MET. I don't know if it's a matter of mismatching at all. I don't think there's anything wrong with CBT or MET. It has to do with the power of the social network. John Kelly, looking back on it, did point out that those who were in randomly assigned to 12-step facilitation had more than double the number of patients who were continuously abstinent at 1 year after treatment and about one-third more at the three-year mark. And then Bill Miller, of course, who developed MET, commenting on Project Match, says that pointed out that 12-step facilitation fare significantly better on the measure of complete abstinence and having a substantial advantage of about 10 percentage points that endured across 3 years. Again, does this mean that CBT or MET are not effective? Not at all. is if you take a look at 12-step facilitation, we'll look at the content a bit later, you'll see that, and if you look at the 12-step fellowships and what goes on, there's a lot of cognitive behavioral work there, and there's a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy that I have integrated into 12-step facilitation shamelessly. And there are also motivational enhancement interventions that are integrated into it. I think that that as clinicians, we need to not think in terms of the silos, you know, at CSF, MET, and CBT, but to try to integrate the best of them. Some more independent random clinical trials, Wallacer et al., Kimberly Wallacer, compared TSF to MET, found that TSF, those randomly assigned to TSF reported more AA meeting attendance, more evidence of active involvement in AA meeting, home meetings, getting a sponsor, so forth, and a higher percentage of days abstinent. So basically, this slide just shows that AA, TSF is evidence-based. It's gone through two separate reviews. Initially was went through a blind review and was listed in the National Registry. Then a couple of years ago, I was invited to resubmit it based on some of the more recent research that's been done. Went through a second blind review and was again listed, this time being listed as approved for alcohol and drug abuse based on the kind of subject samples that, you know, have been in these subsequent randomized clinical trials and for individual or group treatment. Questions so far?
Hello? Joe, this is Mark. We've got about 10 minutes left.
Only move fast.
What's that?
Yep.
Okay,
do you want
just
me to move fast, or do you want to open this for questions?
Either way, I just wanted to note that, you know, I can go on beyond two. I don't know if other people have appointments and so forth. So,
You know, it's up to you guys. If you can, please feel free to shoot me questions, or I'll just move quickly through this, okay?
Okay.
Because I think what it bears on is some of the dynamics of why, you know, what goes on in these in these fellowships and why. So let's take a look at identity. Buckingham, a study in England, looked at people and asked them to identify themselves as either they are recovering alcoholics or recovering addicts versus just I'm an alcoholic or an addict. What they found was interesting was that those people who identified themselves as recovering alcoholics or addicts had higher self-efficacy scores, and that in turn was related to more months clean and sober. So the idea, this kind of bears on the idea that a 12-step facilitation, 12-step fellowships try to promote powerlessness. That does not seem to be the case. Sponsorship study in 2012, take a look at AA attendance and sponsorship over a seven-year period. Remember, AA advises people to get a sponsor and get them soon. And the individuals in the high sponsorship group were seven times more likely to remain abstinent than those in the low sponsorship group. Okay? Move quickly. Connigan and Rice did another study of 253 members who had just begun to attend AA and found having an AA sponsor early, getting one within the first 3 months, increased the probability of complete abstinence at months 4 to 6 by threefold. So the advice, this bears on the advice that people get when they go to an AA meeting, say get a sponsor and get one quickly. Spirituality, interestingly, John Kelly did some work on this in terms of spiritual belief, spiritual activities. He identified people as agnostic, unsure, spiritual, or religious, and then their activities, like praying, meditating, reading. The 12 steps specifically advocate prayer or meditation. They found that higher scores on spirituality or religiousness were positively related to abstinence and negatively to today's drinking. So women in recovery showed significant increases in spiritual beliefs. However, less than half attended formal religious services. So this is kind of interesting if you define how you define spirituality in terms of prayer, meditation, other things like communing with nature, reading materials, so forth, that people seem to become somewhat more spiritual because AA does sort of advocate that. It does advocate things like prayer and meditation. But they don't become more religious in terms of going to religious services. I don't know if people know James Fowler. He was a professor of theology and human development. He developed stages of spiritual development. He was a student of Lawrence Kohlberg. And Fowler makes the point that AA does not promote powerlessness, that what it does is it presents people with a kind of paradoxical choice, that they can become that by admitting powerlessness over opioids or alcohol or whatever it is, they can actually become empowered. And I think that's a powerful statement. They do that by turning to others. And actually, if people know, I am always interested in talking to people who have long-term recovery. And what I find from those conversations is that most of these people are very empowered. They have a very high sense of self-efficacy and self-esteem. So they don't feel powerlessness at all. And this idea that AA promotes a social hierarchy, I'll just lay this out there for people. This is a traditional view of the steps, okay? That you go through step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth, and then you get to the top, okay? And so some people have said, you know, when they go to meetings, they felt looked down on by the people who have more recovery. Here's another traditional view. You sort of walk up these steps, and when I look at them, I wonder, what is at the top of that step, you know? It's spiritual, you know, awakening. Is it heaven? What's there? But here's a Native American view of the 12 steps. And if you'll notice here, Native Americans tend to not think of the 12 steps in terms of steps going upward to anywhere. They tend to think of it in terms of a circle. So these figures that are in this circle, the black one on the east side, starts with step 1. And by the time you get around to step 12, where you've kind of worked this program and experienced this spiritual renewal, that you are ready to go back with step 1 and look at it yourself and help other people. To me, I think that's a kind of interesting way to look at it. Why don't I stop here for that? Okay, because we're running low on time, and see if there's people who have questions. My point here is that the research that was implemented following that white paper on the 12-step model, which had never been subject to rigorous research before, suggests that, in fact, it does work. I think it's most appropriate for those who have severe substance abuse problems. I think for them, the research shows that abstinence is probably the best goal. It also suggests that getting active in a program, like things like getting a sponsor, getting one early, going to meetings, seems to be a pretty good predictor of long-term recovery. So let me throw it up for any comments or questions.
Well, I think it's great that they're actually coming up with more research on showing that AA works. I mean, as somebody who's known about AA for a long time, I mean, I've seen it work many, many, many times and seen a lot of the criticisms. I mean, I understand a lot of the criticisms are based on people from the outside looking in and that they're just not valid. Certainly some of them are, as you mentioned. But it's nice to see this a little bit more, you know, showing a little more proof that AA really does work.
Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that AA is not a treatment program. 12-step facilitation is. So when people go to AA, they can have very different experiences, okay? But as a therapeutic intervention, you know, I'm an advocate, obviously, of therapeutic interventions. I think that we need to incorporate what we know about the power of these fellowships, but we also need to incorporate interventions that have to do with motivation, teaching people cognitive behavioral skills, I think that, that all can contribute to their success. But make no mistake that people, you know, can walk into an AA meeting and have very different experiences.
You know, another point that I've made is that there's no, you know, CBT and MET are not at all mutually exclusive with going to AA and participating in the program.
Right.
And I seem to remember reading that even in Project Match, a lot of the people in the other two conditions were also attending.
That was kind of an interesting artifact there. That the difference was that the people who were in TSF went to more meetings and more likely to get a sponsor because TSF focused on that. But you couldn't prohibit people from going to meetings, and a significant number of people who were in CBT and MET did go to AA meetings, just they migrated there by themselves.
Right. Listen, it's two. I mean, like I said, I can continue for a little while if people want to, but, you know, I know people have to go. But, Joe, thank you so much. This was a great presentation. The slides are really helpful, and just want to give
people. I think people should have the PowerPoint. If you, you know, my contact information is there. So if you want to have a dialogue or about any of this stuff, just feel free to contact me. If you want me to get, you know, the full references, you know, for any particular thing, I'd be glad to look them up. Or you can buy my book.
Yeah, there you go. Just a quick plug, next month we'll be having Catherine Trestrail present. She tried to present last month and there were some technical difficulties, so we're going to shoot again, and she had a very, what struck me as a really good presentation, integrating mindfulness and Kantian self-medication work. So hopefully people come back for that. That will be April 9th. April 8th. Same time, same station. So thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Mark, for doing this.
No problem. All right.
Take care, all.
Thank you very much.
Have a good weekend.